Alright, so let's open to Luke 24:44. Shh. Quiet, please. So again, we're going to continue with evidence for Jesus. Luke 24, verse 44. So this is Jesus, very near the end of his life, obviously. In fact, he's already been resurrected and he's going to ascend. And he says this in verse 44 of Luke 24. This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. Now, this is very similar to what he'd said in John chapter 5, yes? By the way, the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms, those are the three divisions of the Jewish Bible. So basically he's saying, I need to fulfill all the prophecies about the Messiah. And there were many of them. And I'm going to argue that if Jesus fulfilled the prophecies of the Messiah, that alone, apart from all the other evidence we presented, shows us that Jesus is who he says he is, that the Bible is inspired by God, and anybody who doesn't become a Christian is playing a very dangerous game, actually. So let's look at some of the messianic prophecy. Before we do that, I want to purposely take the skeptic's position here. So the skeptics say, well, yeah. All right? So one thing they might say, possibly, is, well, these prophecies that you're talking about were written after Jesus was alive. All right. The problem with that is, that's definitely not true. We know, for example, that the entire Old Testament was translated from Hebrew to Greek in roughly 250 BC. All right? So that's almost 300 years before these events. And if you don't believe that, then you go to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Here's cave number 4, I believe. All right? And we have manuscripts of every book from the Old Testament except Esther, including some entire Old Testament books, such as Isaiah. And these come from the period between 250 BC and roughly 0 AD. So here's the fact that every single one of these prophecies we're going to look at were written at least by 250 BC, but then by that time, they're already accepted as part of the canon of the Old Testament. So certainly at least by 300 BC, which 300 years ago, well, that's a long time, right? So I would say this question is completely answered. Next, the person might say, well, you know, how do I really know that these things actually happened? And that's a fair question. They could say, well, the only way we know these things happened is because the Christians said they happened, but you can't really trust them because they're trying to convert you. Now, I've already talked about this. The idea that they're trying to convert you to something that gets you killed, you know, the quality of these witnesses, the obvious integrity of their lives, really, that's kind of a questionable argument. But as we've already seen, I'm not going to remake that argument, but if I was doing this, if I hadn't already done the other stuff, I'd say, actually, we're going to look at about 8 different prophecies, and most of these prophecies' fulfillment are a matter of record from non-Christians. Okay? Got it? Not all of them, but most of them. All right? They used to say that Tiberius never appointed Pilate as procurator of Judea, showing this whole crucifixion is not true. And then in Caesarea Maritima, they found this inscription, which says, Tiberius Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea. All right, maybe he was actually that. Okay, good. Number three. Well, how do we know these are really prophecies of the Messiah? I mean, maybe, you know, it says, blah, 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 you know, rise into a Jerusalem on a donkey. So Jesus rides in Jerusalem on a donkey, just he's trying to manipulate the facts. Now, we're going to look at eight different prophecies. Seven of those eight were said by the Jews to be prophecies about their Messiah long before Jesus ever lived. Now, one of them will be not that, and I'll explain that when I get there. So, I mean, I suppose it's possible. The problem with that argument is the Jews who don't accept them, they also say these are messianic prophecies. Number four, well, maybe Jesus wants to start a really awesome religion, get everybody to follow him. So what he does is he reads the Old Testament. It says, all right, you know, ride in Jerusalem on a donkey, a colt, a foal, a donkey. All right, great. So, hey, my friend, donkey owner, hey, here's 10 denarius. You know, I'm going to come in. And, right? Doesn't even tell the apostles to go get that guy. All right, there you go. So maybe Jesus is trying to manipulate the situation to claim to be the Messiah. So, and he even makes the statement in Luke 24, right? So maybe that's what's going on here. He's purposely kind of checking off the list. All right? Okay. The problem with that is the prophecies involve getting killed, you know? So if you're trying to start this awesome religion so you get all money and fame and everybody is saying how great you are, you know, it involves death. So I don't know about that. All right. Now, if I was doing this study, I would go to these scriptures, read them carefully. But I'm going to summarize here because this is familiar to you, all right? So prophecy number one, Isaiah 53, 1 through 13. Written roughly 730 BC. That's over 750 years before Jesus' ministry. What was happening in the Philippines 750 years ago? That's basically before recorded history in the Philippines, basically. Anyway, despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering. He was pierced for our transgressions, crushed by our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we're healed. Now, first of all, this is certainly a messianic prophecy, as acknowledged by the Jews for hundreds of years before Jesus came. Now, is it a historical fact that Jesus was despised and rejected? Absolutely. Could Jesus have, knowing he has to do this in order to make this claim, could he have kind of said, all right, great, I got to get despised and rejected? Could he have done that? Absolutely he could have. I mean, say to the Pharisees, you're a bunch of whitewashed tombs and a brood of vipers. Is that going to get you despised and rejected? All right, I'll concede that one. All right, that's fine. Pierced for our transgressions. Now, Jesus not only was crucified, he was also pierced with a spear. Now, could Jesus have arranged to get pierced? Because you got to get pierced. You know? Could Jesus have arranged to be pierced? Well, maybe. He's on the cross. Hey, guys, you're killing me. Get it? You're killing me? You're killing me, huh? We probably shouldn't make a joke about this, but hey, guys, you're killing me. Could you at least do me a favor, all right? After I die, can you do me a favor, all right? Can you pierce me in the side with a spear? My friends, they'll give you, a few denarii if you help me out there. You know, seriously? Oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. And I guess you could argue only the Christians mention this, but the fact is he was killed based on charges which were certainly not true. So I think this happened as well. All right? And then there's Micah 5:2. It says, But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you're small among the clans of Judah, you will come from me, one will be ruler of Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. Certainly a messianic prophecy. In fact, considered by the Jews to be one of the chief messianic prophecies. Now, if you want to be the Messiah, you have to be born in Bethlehem. Now, by the way, where was Jesus born? Oh, okay. And this is a matter of record. This is not just some Christians making it up. All right, so let's say somebody here thinks, all right, I want to be the Messiah. Great, I just got to get myself born in Bethlehem. Could Jesus have arranged that? Well, if he's God, he could, but that kind of proves the point, you know? By the way, there were two cities named Bethlehem. The smaller one, Bethlehem Ephrathah. That's the one that Jesus is from. And then there's Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. But in the future, he'll honor Galilee of the Gentiles by way of the sea along the Jordan. And in case there's any doubt in your mind of whether this is a messianic prophecy, read on. For to us a child is born. He'll be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. This is a messianic prophecy. Now, here's a map showing the tribes of Israel. And you can see where Zebulun is. And you can see where Naphtali is, okay? Got it? From the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. Now I'm going to show you a picture of Palestine during the time of Jesus. Look where Nazareth is. Right on the border between Zebulun and Naphtali. Now if you want to claim to be the Messiah, you have to be born from in Bethlehem, but you have to come from the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. How many people alive today, of 7.5 billion people, how many would be qualified on this, having been born in Bethlehem, but having come from the region of Zebulun and Naphtali? I'm sure there's a couple dozen like that. Of course, Jesus is qualified on that basis. Psalm 22. By the way, of all the ones we're looking at, this is the only one that is not clearly and obviously a messianic prophecy. There's nothing in this psalm that would have caused the Jews to say, this is about our Messiah, unlike the other ones. And yet, history leaves only one reasonable way to think about this. Because look at this. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men has encircled me. They've pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Did you know, by the way, written by David, 1000 BC, and this psalm is in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Did you know that crucifixion wasn't even invented until 300 BC by the Persians? But they did not pierce hands and feet. The Romans, around 100 BC, practiced piercing of hands and feet. Now imagine you're David writing this about 1000 BC. They had pierced my hands and my feet. Like, why did I just write that? That's really weird. All right, I'll write that down. Now, how did Jesus die? By crucifixion. How do I know that? Well, because Tacitus said it, and Josephus said it, and the writer of the Talmud said it. I would say the crucifixion of Jesus is as much an established fact of ancient history as virtually any other fact of ancient history, okay? Could Jesus have arranged to be crucified? Well, the answer is, believe it or not, that's hard to do. Because the Jews weren't allowed to crucify. And why would the Romans want to kill him? I could see the Jews wanting to kill him, but how are they going to get him? That was actually a challenge, and you know the story of how it happened. I think with Pontius Pilate. I can count all my bones. This is prophesied in multiple ways. There are other prophecies that say not a bone will be broken. That's also in the Old Testament. And then in the Passover, God specifically said, don't break any of the bones of the Passover lamb, which was the favorite part of the lamb, by the way, the stuff inside the bone. All right, now, as you know, when Jesus was crucified, he died within about 3, 4, 5 hours. It was the eve of the Passover. It was considered blasphemy to have these people up there on the cross. So they requested specifically to end the crucifixions. They break the legs of the thieves, because if you break their legs, they can no longer push up and they die within minutes. But they come to Jesus and none of his legs are broken, of course. And also, what did they do while he's on the cross? Did they divide his garments or did they gamble? Which did they do? They did both. They divided them, and when they got to the inner garment, it was too valuable. Could Jesus have arranged? Because remember, if you want to be the Messiah, you got to get crucified. But also they have to both divide and gamble. So can you imagine Jesus on the cross in agony? Say, hey guys, that inner garment, do you see that it's woven of one material? Hey, my advice is don't rip it, you know? At some point, the case becomes unassailable. At some point, believing that Jesus is not the one who fulfilled the prophecies of the Messiah becomes, really, I would say, irrational. It's evidence that a person is simply not thinking straight. Now, you know, atheists are aware of this, so they try to come up with arguments. For example, I'm not kidding. And where it says pierced, they have pierced my hands and my feet. The Hebrew word can mean pierced, but can also mean camel. So it has two possible meanings. So they say, well, he meant camel. So they've cameled my hands. You know, seriously. I'm not kidding. That is their argument. Anyway. All right, Zechariah. I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. How many? 30. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the handsome price at which they priced me. God is saying that I was sold by my people for 30 pieces of silver. By the way, this is one of the strongest arguments that Jesus is God. Just so you know. So I took the 30 pieces of silver, threw them into the house of the Lord to the potter. Now, you have to look at the context here. Broke the union and staff and all that. This is clearly a messianic prophecy. By the way, how much was Jesus betrayed for? 30. How do you know that? Because they said that's what it was. Well, why do they do that? Because they're trying to create a lying case? That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, if you're trying to create a lie, you don't add details that aren't true. Because if it wasn't 30 pieces of silver, then when you wrote it down, because I'm telling you, when this was written down, you know, when Matthew was written, some of the people who were there at the time in that room when it was 30 pieces of silver are still alive. How many of the people in this room will be alive in 30 years? I would wager probably over 3/4 of you will still be alive. Right? So, I'm telling you, it was 30 pieces of silver. Right, could Jesus have arranged this one? I don't think so. It wasn't even there. You know, I like to imagine these guys who counted out the 30 pieces of silver. I like to imagine them reading Zechariah, maybe, you know, 6 months, 2 years later, going, man, should have paid him 100 pieces. You know, Jesus is the Messiah. He is God. We have clear evidence. Now, at what point do you go from evidence to proof? You know, in the U.S., we have the standards called beyond a reasonable doubt, right? And in a historical kind of argument, you can't prove mathematically. It's literally impossible. But I think you can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Jesus is the Messiah. No reasonable person can doubt it. All right, and by the way, what you know what happened to those 30 pieces of silver? Well, we're not sure exactly why, but Judas later on repented. I believe it's because he was hoping Jesus would rebel and start a rebellion, and he didn't. His plan wasn't working. I don't think Judas was trying to get him killed. Why would he do that? But it didn't work, so he comes back and he says, "Here, take the money." They say, "We can't take that money. It's blood money." So what did they do? They bought a potter's field, which is a place where they had the shards of the pottery and used it for a graveyard for Gentiles. Oh, okay. I got it. Then there's Daniel 9. This is my last one. Not that there are not many others that we could use. It's just that we got limited time here. And at some point, if you will not accept the evidence, then what's even the point of presenting more evidence? I mean, you know, what's the point? There would be no point. If a person cannot see the obvious implication of these verses, then, you know, they will deny that they have a hand, or, you know, they deny that you're sitting next to them. Okay, Daniel 9. All right, if you look at the context, Daniel's reading Jeremiah that says, 70 years and I will come and save my people. Daniel's been in captivity for about 68 or 69 years. So basically it says, God, hey, come on, let's get this thing rolling here. And so here's what happens. 24. 70 sevens are decreed for your people in your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. To anoint the Messiah. The actual word here is Messiah. 77s are decreed for your people in your holy city to finish transgression. Good. Know and understand this, that the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the Messiah, comes. There'll be 7 sevens and 62 sevens will be rebuilt, etc. Now, 77s. That's 490, and it's 490 years. The context says that. That's the 70 years, okay? Now, was there ever a decree issued to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? The answer is absolutely. It's in Ezra chapter 7. In Ezra chapter 1, Cyrus said to go back and build the temple, but not the city. Okay? The year is the 7th year of Artaxerxes, which is 458 BC. Now let's subtract 490 from 458. That is negative 32. All right? That would be 32 AD. Except for the fact that there's no year zero. The year zero didn't happen. The calendar goes from 1 BC to 1 AD. Oh, okay. So, this is a prophecy about a decree that was not made for quite a long time after the prophecy was made, that the Messiah would come to Jerusalem to make a sacrifice to bring in everlasting righteousness in the year 33 AD. All right. Now, actually, that's not exactly what it says. If you read it carefully, it's after 7 sevens and 62 sevens. What it's really saying is during the final week. In other words, if you study this carefully, it's saying somewhere between 27 AD and 33 AD, during that last week, okay? And by the way, 30 AD, which is when Jesus was probably killed, is right in the middle of that week. So if you want to claim to be the Messiah, you got a few requirements. You have to be despised and rejected. You have to be pierced and crucified. You have to be silent when accused. You have to be born in Bethlehem, raised in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali. Your bones can't be broken, and you have to be gambled. Your garments have to be gambled and divided. You have to be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, and the money has to be used for the potter. And all this has to come true in the year roughly 30 AD in Jerusalem. So how many people are qualified on each of these? So, my question is, how could anybody not believe that Jesus is the Messiah? The answer is, because you didn't present this evidence to them. So that's your job. It's your job. Okay? All right. Let's talk about miracles. Now, the fact that Jesus worked miracles, I believe, is a historical fact. Now, we're not talking about miracles, you know, like you have your Pentecostal church, right? And they walk up on stage and they're like, and then, you know, the whammo-bammo thing, and then they're like, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a massive storm. And Jesus says, quiet. Alright? I'd like to see one of these Pentecostal... I don't mean to be disrespectful, alright? Seriously. In fact, I think we can learn from the Pentecostals a few things. Seriously. So, I want to be respectful. But I'd like to see one of these awesome, amazing Pentecostal gifts people just put a glass of water up there and let's see if they can turn that into wine. Okay? And I hope I'm not saying that to disrespect somebody, but just to point out that Jesus as a miracle worker, this is not within any range that, you know, maybe there's other miracle workers as well. All right, now, the way I see it, there's four choices. All right, I'm kind of a logic guy. I'm a scientist, all right? So either he didn't work miracles and he never claimed to work miracles. But this is certainly not true because we know from the evidence whether he worked miracles you could debate, but whether he claimed them, there's no possible debate there. He claimed to work miracles, but he was a charlatan. He was a magician, a sorcerer. Number three, he worked miracles, but really they were satanic rather than, you know, from God. Or he worked miracles, in which case he is the Son of God, God in the flesh, Messiah, and Lord, and you better repent and rebaptize, otherwise you've got a big problem going. Okay? The way I see it is, though, if you could come up with another possibility, I've thought about it for a long time, and it seems like those are the only options. Okay, got it? So which one is true? Well, there are a number of reasons why I believe Jesus did, in fact, work miracles. First of all, these were done in public, often in front of hundreds and even thousands of people, and the attendees at these events included those who hated him and were trying to kill him. This is a fact. All right? Number two, tens of thousands of eyewitnesses, including the common people as well as people who were highly educated from every level of society. Number three, the fact that he worked miracles was publicly proclaimed in Jerusalem in front of thousands of people, and no one said, oh, wait a minute, right? Acts 2. Peter says, Jesus, who is a worker of signs, wonders, and miracles, as you yourselves know. Nobody's saying, really, I hadn't heard about those miracles. No, really? They didn't tell me. Seriously? What's been going on here? I mean, even those who do not accept Christianity Scholars who study it agree whether he worked miracles is not in doubt. I'm sorry, is in doubt, but that it was claimed by the early church that he did. There's no doubt. That was clearly claimed from the beginning. Number four, both Roman and Jewish histories report at least the fact that Jesus worked wonders. In other words, even the non-Christians say, they may not say he worked great miracles, they would say he did wonders, or he was doing it by sorcery or something like that. The Pharisees and the rabbis did not deny the miracles, they tried to explain them as being satanic. And the eyewitnesses have every evidence of being highly credible. All right? Now, I wish I had time to do this lesson about the miracles Jesus did not do. It's really encouraging. I'm going to skip these things. Now, I want to get to the resurrection. All right? We're going to talk about the resurrection. Now, I like talking about the resurrection. The reason is that the resurrection of Jesus kind of clears the stage, you know, pretty much. People say, well, you know, what about Constantine? And, you know, he's changed the New Testament. Or, well, you know, maybe you're a young Christian. You don't know all that stuff. Say, I don't know, but Jesus was raised from the dead. You know? Well, what about, you know, the Crusades? Or, you know, what about, you know, this discrepancy in the Bible? And, you know, how do you deal with the fact that this religious leader, you know, committed adultery? I don't know. Jesus was raised from the dead. You know, it's kind of, you know, if Jesus was raised from the dead, it kind of, you know, it seems to answer a lot of questions. A lot of things are true. If Jesus was raised from the dead, then, for example, he is a miracle worker. What he said is true. So, you know, John 3:19, Jesus said, destroy this temple, I'll raise it again in 3 days. Okay, now, let's talk about some facts here. I want to list three facts. Again, this is my argument for the resurrection. Fact number one, it is a fact that Jesus was crucified in Jerusalem under Pontius Pilate. The evidence for this is airtight, ironclad. You know what I'm saying? All right, I'm not going to do these quotes again, but we have plenty of them. Fact number two, from the beginning, in other words, in Jerusalem, in the immediate context, within just a very short time of 50 days, the resurrection of Jesus was proclaimed. I'm not saying it's a fact that he was raised. I'm saying it's a fact that it was claimed that he was raised. And like I said, even the skeptics, even the atheists who study Christianity will concede that from the very beginning, obviously, his resurrection was claimed. I mean, there's no way to explain the growth of the church other than that. So it's a fact that he was crucified. It's a fact that his resurrection was claimed publicly. And it's a fact that the tomb was empty. Three facts. Definitely crucified, no doubt about it. The resurrection was a public claim by his followers in Jerusalem immediately afterwards, and the tomb was empty. I mean, that much we know for sure. Because if the tomb had not been empty, then what would the Jews have done? Common sense. If the tomb was not empty, then what would the Jews have done? They would have said, hey, you say Jesus is dead. Let me show you something. Here's his body. So, I would say it's an incontrovertible fact that the tomb where his body was put is empty. It was empty. Now, I would argue, although I'm not going to put it on a slide, I would argue there's a fourth fact, which is that he was actually alive afterward. Now, I'm not going to put it up on the screen, but if you go to 1 Corinthians 15, starting, verse 2 or 3, Paul mentions casually that, well, it was observed by the women and by James and John and then the apostles. and then to 500 eyewitnesses, most of whom are still around, just go talk to them, and also me. Now, my question is, in order to establish as a fact a particular thing, how many eyewitnesses would it take? So, for example, that person was at that crime scene. If one person says, I saw him, you know, people, you know, two people said, I saw him, he was there. 500 eyewitnesses, all of whom lived the entire rest of their life under threat of immediate imprisonment and death merely for the fact that they were witnesses of the resurrection. I would argue you could add a fourth fact, which is that his tomb, he was alive, actually. All right, now, David Hume famously said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And I'll have to admit, to claim that Jesus was raised from the dead is not the same as claiming that you got an A on your test, all right? It's not like claiming my hair used to be blonde. It's not like claiming that chocolate chip cookies taste better than, I don't know, whatever. All right, to claim that Jesus was raised from the dead, that's a truly extraordinary claim. You have to admit. You cannot blame the unbeliever for not believing that. Seriously, you have to admit that. So we have to create a very, very strong case. But I believe we have a very, very strong case. Because of the facts. The crucifixion, the claim of resurrection, the empty tomb, and arguably the fact that he was alive. All right? So what are the options? Again, if there were other options than these, then somebody would have come up with one sometime in the last 2,000 years. Because there's a lot of people who don't believe that he is Messiah. For example, the Jews. All right, so as far as I know, these are the only explanations that anybody's had the nerve to propose. So maybe, although he was crucified, and although it is true they claimed his raised from the dead, actually they stole his body, and it's a big conspiracy and a lie. All right, we'll talk about that. That's one option. It explains why the tomb was empty. It's consistent with all the facts. Oh, except the fourth one, that he was alive, but never mind that. Okay, number two, it's called the swoon theory, which is, well, he didn't really actually die. Now, that would explain why the tomb was empty, all right? And then the third one is he was raised from the dead. So let's talk about the first one, body stolen. All right, so who stole the body? Would the Romans steal the body? Why would they steal the body? You know, please give me a reason for this. They have no conceivable reason. All right, the Jews, would the Jews have stolen the body? It's not inconceivable they would have stolen the body, seriously, so that they could hide it and then present it later on. But the problem is, we know they didn't present it later on. So the only possible people who would have a motivation to steal his body would be the followers. But the idea they would steal their body is so crazy that no person with any sense could really believe it. So imagine these people all in hiding. None of them even showed up to the crucifixion except John. They're all in hiding. They're sitting around, man, our leader is dead. Somebody says, I know. Let's pretend that he didn't die. They just raised from the dead. Oh, great idea. You're great. So we're going to start this religion based on a total lie. And everyone in this room's got to keep this secret. Nobody has to admit it. So what we're going to do is we're going to go out. There's the guard, say 10 soldiers. And so we're going to, maybe karate kick them or maybe punch them or I don't know. So Would they have done it? They had no possible reason to steal his body. For what would be the motive? To start a false religion that they didn't believe in? But let's say they want, let's just say, all right, yeah, let's just accept this crazy idea that they said, let's steal the body so we can say he was raised from the dead. All right, so how would they have done it? Give me a scenario. You know, I was in on a jury a couple years ago, and it was very frustrating. It was 11-1 for conviction. This one woman wouldn't convict. She said, I'm not sure. And we said, the standard is not sure. The standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the guy's fingerprints and DNA were on the gun and on the bullets in the gun. I don't know. We said to her, how did his DNA get on the gun and on the bullets in the gun? Could you give us a scenario by which they got there other than, you know, it was him? She couldn't come up with one. What do you do with something like that? I'm telling you, the guy was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would say beyond a reasonable doubt, they did not steal the body. So let's say they decided to steal the body, all right? So they're getting some clubs and some weapons, and they're charging these soldiers, and they're beating them up, and they kill them all. And then, what about the next day? Do you think there might be some evidence? Do you think there might be some Roman soldier bodies there? You know? This is insane. I'm telling you right now, of our three possibilities, they definitely did not steal his body. All right. Then there's the swoon theory. The idea that he didn't really actually die. All right. Remember, there's only three options, the swoon theory. So here's the deal. It's true that he hadn't had any water or food for, 3 days. That's true. In addition, it is also true that he was beaten 40 lashes minus one, which probably would have killed him in any case. But, all right. And it is true that he was crucified. It is true that he was dead. And the Romans are pretty good at knowing when somebody's dead, you know? And the fact is, once you stop pushing up, you die. You cannot fake a death with a crucifixion. Besides, why would you do that? You know? And besides, after dying, he's obviously dead. I mean, and then they stick a spear in his side, and water and blood comes out. And by the way, roughly 90 minutes after you die, the plasma separates, so that could happen. So he's dead twice over. He's killed, and then given another fatal wound on top of that after he's killed. They drag him off to the tomb, and then he kind of wakes up, shakes it all off, moves this massive rock, and then, you know the soldiers? He kind of karate chops them, kicks them, and he kills them all, and then nobody notices that. I mean, anybody who believes this is how can you have a discussion on this basis? Okay? Let me tell you this, folks. Jesus was raised from the dead on the third day. He was. He was raised from the dead. It was prophesied. Yeah, the resurrection kind of simplifies things for me. You know? What about this? What about that? I don't know. But Jesus was raised from the dead. The evidence here, because Jesus fulfilled the prophecies of the Messiah, because he was resurrected, the only rational conclusion is that he is who he says he is. the Messiah, the Lord, God in the flesh, the one who has all authority in heaven and on earth. So I say to the person you studied with, let's start talking about your sins. Okay? Now, I'm going to set up the next lesson. I'm not going to go through it. My job is to end the next 5 minutes or so. All right, but I want to set the stage for the next one. Okay? This is bonus material that's not in your outline. How many of you have heard me give my lesson from Shadow to Reality? From Shadow to Reality. All right, just a couple of you. And I'm telling you, for me, this stuff is even better for me as evidence for Jesus being who the Bible says he is. So I don't have time to go through this lesson, and I'm going to do a very fast version of it after lunch anyway, because we need to cover some material. But I'm telling you, for me, as a Christian myself, it's this material that I go back to all the time. That not just sealing that Jesus is who he says he is, which that's kind of important, you know. Not just sealing the Messiah, but sealing as unassailable fact that the entire scripture is inspired by God. So I'm going to set this up and do the study afterwards. Now, we already saw how Jesus says you diligently study the scriptures. And it's by you fail to notice that it's all about me. And, you know, when you read the Old Testament, when you look at prefigures and foreshadows, as we're going to do, you find the most amazing, mind-blowing, smoking gun evidence, if you will, that Jesus is the Messiah. It's really quite something else. The way I think about the Old Testament is like a play. But it's a very unusual play, because in this play, the actors have no idea what the play's about. But the audience, us, we get it. Wouldn't that be a strange play? But that's what the Old Testament is like. Because again and again and again, I'm not talking about 10 times, I'm not talking about 100 times, I'm talking about 1,000 times, the life, the ministry, the teaching of Jesus are acted out in types, prefigures, and foreshadows. A foreshadow being an event, a small little event, that tells the story of something greater but in the future. Or a prefigure, which is something in the past, which is almost an exact picture of something in the future. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you one example of this, and then we'll break for lunch. Just one example. And that is Numbers 21, 4 through 9. Let's read that. This will be the last thing before we break for lunch. Numbers 21, 4 through 9. They traveled from Mount Hor around the route to the Red Sea to get around Edom, but the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There's no bread, there's no water, and we detest this miserable food." Now you would think they'd be grateful that they were saved out of Egypt, you know what I'm saying? But no, they're not doing a good job here. Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses prayed for the people. So the Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake, put it up on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live." So Moses made a bronze snake, put it up on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, they lived. Now, in this story, how many snake bites would it take in order to die? One. In this story, the snake bites represent sin. Trust me. If you don't trust me, let's finish the story. You'll see. Right, how many sins does it take for you to die spiritually if you're separated from God? One. The wages of sin or death. All right, so the people have sinned, and the snakes are coming. and now they're all dying. And so the people who were saying bad stuff about Moses, now they're saying, Moses, help us out. Moses goes to God and say, what should we do? God says, make an idol. Make a bronze image of a snake. Put it up on a wooden pole. And then when people look at this bronze snake on the wooden pole, then they'll be saved from the snake bites. Now imagine you're Moses. All right, God, help me out here. You've already told us to never, ever make an image. Now you want me to make an image. Okay? Now, an image of a snake. And as we all know, the snake represents Satan or sin. All right, if you say so. But remember, Moses is an actor in a play, the subject of which he has no idea. But we know, because we can read John 3:14, where it says, just as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, I too must be lifted up. So the entire gospel message is found in this little story. What's the problem? Sin. What's the only solution? To look to Jesus, who just like in this situation in the desert, was lifted up on a wooden pole. And Jesus says, if you look to me as I am lifted up, you will be saved. But the confusing part is, why a snake? Why a snake? That's confusing. But then I read 2 Corinthians 5:21, which says, God made him who knew no sin to become sin for us on the cross. Now I get it. So the message of Numbers 21, 4 through 9 is that we have sinned. The wages of sin are death. The only solution is to look to Jesus, who, while he was lifted up on the wooden pole, received all of our sins on him. And if we do that, his death will substitute for our death. Now here's the point. How did Moses know that? I mean, how did this even happen? It's amazing. All right, anyway, we'll see more examples like that, but we're going to take a break. Let's say 1:30. Is that enough? Is it an hour and 15? Should we do 1:45? What do you think? Roland, you know better than I. 1:45. Yeah, I think that's more reasonable. 1:45.